people have underestimated electricity demand, primarily because of AI and data centers. And we've seen really dramatic things. One of the tech companies making a deal for Three Mile Island. And you've seen these warnings coming from the people who run the transmission systems, saying that we could have a real reliability problem by the end of this decade in the United States. I've talked to some of the big tech companies and the people with big plans, and they're really kind of racing around figuring out where we're going to get our electricity supply. We're going to see that more of it's going to come from natural gas, and the supply system for providing natural gas turbines is maxed out. I mean, you're going to have to wait years to get supply.
I'm Jim Haskell, editor of the Bridgewater Daily Observations. When investors look at the macro shifts happening around the world today, from the rise of AI and the energy demand it creates, to modern mercantilism and the reshaping of supply chains, to President Trump's recent series of pro-energy executive actions, it's just notable that many of those shifts will directly impact energy markets. And so with that in mind, in today's Daily Observations podcast, we're sharing a conversation that senior portfolio strategist Adil Lele recently had with Daniel Yergin, one of the world's leading energy experts. By way of background, Dan is vice chair at S&P Global. He's the author of several books, including The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power, which won a Pulitzer Prize, and The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. Dan has been a regular on our podcast over the last few years. In the following discussion, Dan and Adil talk about how the energy landscape has changed over the past few years. They scan across countries, touching on both supply and demand dynamics and the implications for investors. Let's get right into the discussion with Daniel Yergin.
Hi, Dan. Thanks again for joining us on this podcast. We thought there'd be no one better to speak with to understand the changing landscape of supply and demand in the energy market, and really importantly, the impact we're going to see on energy prices and the structure of markets more broadly. To create an arc for the conversation, we thought we'd first walk through the big supply and demand dynamics at play, and then secondly, move on to the implications. So, firstly, on supply and demand, let's start with supply and go by region. It's been 3 years since the publication of the revised edition of your book, The New Map. And over that time, the US energy landscape has shifted very significantly. We're now at the point where the US exports, in terms of LNG, half as much energy as it does semiconductors. And it's now really a global supplier of energy. And of course, now you have President Trump coming in with a series of executive orders, which look aimed at bolstering natural gas supply even further. So what are your reflections over the past 3 years, looking at how the US and the global energy landscape have changed, especially as it pertains to LNG and the US now as a net supplier?
Well, if we take LNG, it's been quite extraordinary. The US was not exporting any liquefied natural gas until early 2016. Today, it's the largest exporter of LNG. So that itself is a major development. It's transformed really the global market for gas. I think the second thing that's happened, of course, in the new map, I kind of saw that there was going to be a struggle between Ukraine and Russia, but never expected to see a war that would be going on as long as it has. And that's changed the global oil market. In fact, what it's done is mean that it's no longer a global oil market. Before the invasion, the U.S. was importing 600,000 barrels a day of Russian oil. It was a global market. Barrels went to, for the most part, where it meant economic sense. Now we have a partitioned global oil market. So I think that's a change. I think a third change that I see is that the oil market had really counted for decades on Chinese economic growth, half of total growth in oil demand. That's not happening anymore. China's growth in demand is much more muted than it was. So I would say I would put that down as a major change. And then I think, actually AI, because of what it does to electricity demand. Suddenly in the United States, people are talking not about security of supply in terms of oil and gas. They're talking about it in terms of electricity. You know, one thing that's always fascinating about the energy world is it never stands still.
That was a great scan across the world. So can we just dig into a few of those countries? Let's start with the US and some of the changes that we're seeing under President Trump. Now that he's in the White House again, a lot of investors, including ourselves, are paying close attention to what the pivot in US energy policy means for energy markets on the supply side. On his first day in office, President Trump announced four executive orders, declaring a national energy emergency, an executive order for unleashing American energy, an executive order for offshore wind, and an executive order on unleashing Alaska's natural resource potential. Now, a lot's been made of these, certainly from the administration, But do you see those orders as actually having a meaningful impact on U.S. energy supply?
Yes, I do. I mean, but they won't unfold immediately. They'll take time to do that. But if we take his energy emergency, it's really about two things. One, it's about solving this problem of permitting, of getting things done, which just goes on and on. It's estimated, we did a study, the average length of time to bring a new mine on in the United States is 29 years. And the other thing is specifically addressing data center, the growth in electricity demand, and natural gas, and facilitating the development of those supplies to make sure there's electricity to support what sure looks like an AI boom.
And Dan, one of the more explicit goals we've heard from the Trump team is Scott Bessent's 333 proposal, where one of the threes was increasing daily oil production in the US by 3 million barrels a day. How likely is that? And how do you see that playing out if it does happen?
I think it depends what kind of barrels you're doing. If you're talking about barrels of crude oil, that's going to be very tough, although there is a sense that the U.S. can still grow some. But if you say it's barrels of oil equivalent, and you put in natural gas liquids, and you put in natural gas, then I think it's something that can certainly be done over the next couple of years, particularly if you can unlock some of the permitting issues that we talked about and infrastructure and put in some pipelines to move natural gas from areas you can't now, then I think if you talk about barrels of oil equivalent, it's doable.
And on the easing of regulations, we've written before in our daily observations that actually the binding constraint for U.S. energy production seems to have been more from the capital discipline from producers as opposed to regulation. Do you see it the same way?
If you talk to the companies, you'll find that they feel that there's been, particularly in this last 4 years, a real increase in regulatory burdens, ability to get things approved and done. But at the same time, you know, the energy companies are economic animals, and they basically respond to market forces. And one market force is price, and the other is the imposition of capital discipline, which, contrary to what the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, said in some of its recent decisions, did not come from overseas. It came from institutional investors, from the financial markets, who say, you know, it's great to invest, it's great to grow, but we want returns.
Staying focused on the supply side, but shifting now to Europe and the security of supply situation. Europe has managed to pivot away from its reliance on Russian energy. What do you see as the future here? Will the US play a bigger role? And would that be by virtue of Europe's needs or more of a consequence of the US energy policy shifting?
You know, I guess that's another thing that goes to that question, that another big change is energy security really wasn't on the agenda until the invasion of Ukraine. And now it's something that Europe actually really worries about. I think Vladimir Putin assumed that he could use the energy weapon, cutting off gas, to shatter the coalition, the European coalition supporting Ukraine. And he could have, because of the economic costs, except for U.S. LNG, which replaced 40% of that Russian gas. So U.S. LNG and LNG in general has become an important part of Europe's energy economy. There's some buzz, will Russian gas come back? And Europe is importing, by the way, Russian LNG. It's about 17% of its LNG supplies. The pipeline gas is mostly stopped. And I think were there to be peace in Ukraine and some greater confidence, we would see Russian gas return. But that's a very big if. And I don't think Europe will ever return to the kind of reliance that it had on Russian gas or trust Russia or Russian gas.
And if we think about the other side of the ledger, which is Russia, it appears to have navigated sanctions pretty well from an energy perspective by continuing to supply both China and India and generating revenues to fund its wartime economy. How do you see those relationships developing between Russia, China, and India, and potentially Russia and other players? Do you see something like the Power of Siberia Pipeline 2 or 3 or 4 someday in the future?
Well, I noticed that President Xi Jinping of China sent his New Year's greetings to Russia and to Putin, saying Russia and China walk hand in hand. So I think a consequence of the war in Ukraine is that those two countries are much closer together. Obviously, Russia's really become an economic dependency of China in particular, and that's accentuated, of course, by the growing tensions between the United States and China today. China and India have been big beneficiaries of sanctioned Russian oil selling at a discount. I think new sanctions were put on just as the Biden administration was walking out the door. It finally put sanctions on Russia that could actually limit its supply, because the Biden administration did not want to limit supply because it was worried about gasoline prices going up. But by putting sanctions on in January, if gasoline prices were to go up, that would be Donald Trump's problem, not Joe Biden's problem. But these now are tougher sanctions. And now the question is just going to be the enforcement, because they could have an impact. And by the way, there's a lot of other sort of shut-in capacity, as it's called, or spare capacity, particularly in the Middle East, that can replace Russian oil. And that Russian oil is very important, as you point out, central to Putin's ability to finance his economy and to finance the war.
And now turning to the Middle East. The Middle East has really transformed itself in recent years in terms of how income from energy is deployed both domestically and externally, in terms of their opening up to the outside world, and to some degree in terms of the political systems, which has shifted as well. And that said, when we look at how this income is being deployed, it's not really clear as yet whether all of these projects will be productive. And of course, there's still a number of geopolitical flashpoints in the region. How do you see the Middle East and its role in global energy markets changing from where we are today?
The Middle East mainly looks to Asia as its market. That's the first thing to note. Saudi oil competes in China with Russian oil. And so they don't really have a market anymore in the Western Hemisphere. I remember a senior Saudi saying to me, you know, there's these very ambitious goals for Project 2030. He said, well, if we achieve 65 or 70% of it, we've achieved a lot. Obviously, they took on a lot. For their purposes, it's better to have higher oil prices. They are installing both solar and increasing their gas use and electric generation to free up more oil for export. And then Abu Dhabi is also substantially increasing its capacity. And Kuwait is now launching an effort to try and upgrade and capture more market share for oil. So I think altogether, those countries will continue to be major suppliers and have the capacity and the technology to do it. But it's not the same world where it was before, where the U.S. was the world's largest importer. It's definitely a different balance. And, you know, the Middle Eastern countries would prefer a different price point than the White House would prefer.
So stepping back and aggregating global energy supply, if I were to synthesize what we just discussed, it seems like there's a lot of supply coming from the US, certainly a lot from the Middle East, and a lot from Russia as well. So at least in the near term, global energy supply looks pretty robust, doesn't it?
I always say, when people say, well, what's the price going to be? My first question, what's GDP going to be? And the second question now is, what's going to happen with tariffs, sanctions, and everything else? But with that said, I think our basic expectation is that in 2025, we're going to see oil prices on average lower than they were in 2024. And that's because the supply is going to outpace demand.
Turning to demand, climate policies, growth in Asia, and now artificial intelligence all look like long-term dynamics that have been reshaping energy demand. And all three of these have evolved pretty rapidly over recent years. We'd like to go into how you see these pressures playing out, starting with what's top of mind for us and a lot of people, which is artificial intelligence. This has been getting a lot of attention for the large amount of energy needed to power data centers. Now, that's already having a significant impact on the US energy industry. Do you have any thoughts as to how that demand would be satisfied?
People have underestimated what electricity demand, how it will result, primarily because of AI and data centers. One of the big tech companies said they're opening a new data center every 3 days. Not all of them are huge, but some of them are huge. And we've seen really dramatic things, sort of page turners. One of the tech companies making a deal for Three Mile Island for the reactor that wasn't damaged, but restarting it. And you've seen these warnings coming from the people who run the transmission systems, saying that we could have a real reliability problem by the end of this decade in the United States. The estimate we've been doing is that data center demand might rise from about 4% of electricity in the U.S. to 10% by 2030. I saw the U.S. Department of Energy said it could rise to 12% by 2028, which, if I count on my fingers, is not very far away. I've talked to some of the big tech companies and the people with big plans, and they're really kind of racing around figuring out where we're going to get our electricity supply. They would have thought, we'll get it from renewables. Well, actually, we're going to see that more of it's going to come from natural gas. And the supply system for providing natural gas turbines is maxed out. I mean, you're going to have to wait years to get supply. So there really is pressure in the system. I was talking recently to somebody from one of the organizations, and he was saying how they're going around the country trying to figure out where to get the best power deal. And is it going to be, I mean, they'd like to do renewables, but maybe it'll be natural gas generation next to a data center, putting data centers next to natural gas fields. And then you've seen, you know, which wasn't on the agenda 3 or 4 years ago, the serious interest in nuclear power. The last estimates I saw is that $6 or $7 billion has gone into from VC investment into fusion. Fusion used to be something that governments did, and it was not going to work for 50 years, and small nuclear reactors. So there is a focus on electricity in a way that there hasn't been for many years.
So getting more specific on the sources of that demand, we've talked about how supply looks likely to outstrip demand in the short term, but it sounds like over the long term, you see energy demand accelerating, in part thanks to the energy-intensive AI boom. So how do you see that playing out? What are the most likely sources of supply for such an energy-intensive industry? Is it more LNG or nuclear or what?
Well, I don't think it won't be LNG here. I think it would be conventional natural gas generation. And natural gas today provides about half of U.S. electricity. The Biden administration was determined to phase it out unless it had carbon capture, which was going to be very challenging. So this is a big reversal. You know, I sat in a meeting with one of the tech companies, and their own teams were very divided as to where the sources would be, whether the mix would be renewables, conventional generation, revived nuclear, natural gas. Our own view and my own view is that natural gas is going to end up playing, particularly with this administration, a much more significant role than had been expected or would have been anticipated 2 years ago. And by the way, you have electricity demand coming from other things too, EVs, reshoring of manufacturing, electrification, and crypto mining. It's estimated today that crypto mining in Texas uses as much electricity as the city of Austin, and they expect the crypto mining demand to double in a few years. So there's suddenly this sort of flat, predictable business of electric power is now looking at a surge of demand, and utilities' fundamental goal is to provide reliable power. So there's going to be a lot of action there.
Yeah, and the national security element here is really interesting with regards to AI. I mean, you mentioned crypto at the end there, but we never saw the same national security considerations behind crypto that we're now seeing with AI. And that seems to be driving a lot of political narrative behind the need for energy abundance today, because if AI is really going to be critical for national security, a lot of the usual barriers around increasing energy production, permitting or environmentalism, for example, seem to be less constraining politically. And finally, on the politics, it seems like many of the AI hyperscalers are making a point of generating their off-power grid because they don't want to be seen as pushing up energy prices for the rest of the market. So they're willing to do things like make 10-year commitments like we never saw with crypto, where there was just no way you would commit to a multi-decade commitment for such a volatile end product.
Yeah, because in fact, you see the crypto miners can go in Texas go up and down depending upon the overall market, and the hyperscalers need 24 reliable energy. And I think your point about national security is an important one, because if we think about part of the way the whole issue has been phrased, it's been a national security and goes back to that basic issue of competition with China and rivalry with China, and that we have to stay ahead.
And now turning to demand from China and India, they've been two huge economies, and most of the delta in global energy demand backward looking has come from them. How do you see their consumption patterns changing in terms of energy intensity and in terms of which sources of energy they use? And then finally, where that supply actually comes from?
Well, China, imports 75% of its oil. And a lot of that oil comes through the South China Sea. And the Chinese know what happened during World War II when U.S. submarines, beginning about 1944, began to sink the tankers. And I remember one of the Japanese admirals said, you know, our battleships will soon be scarecrows. So they are very keen to reduce their oil consumption or flatten it out. When I was in China, and our own analysis suggests that somewhere between about 2027 and 2030, their oil demand flattens out. Clearly, they're still adding coal plants, and they have a big commitment to renewables. President Xi Jinping has talked about China dominating the new industrial supply chains. China will continue to be a very substantial consumer of energy and of oil, but it won't have, when it comes to oil, it won't have the same kind of growth. they may be the biggest importer now of LNG rather than Japan, or certainly rivaling Japan. They want that to come from a variety of sources. Obviously, U.S. LNG is one way, and that goes back to the first Trump administration to help to shrink this awesome trade deficit that the U.S. has. But we saw that the Chinese just responded to the Trump tariffs by putting tariffs on both LNG and U.S. oil, two important markets to U.S. producers. India's oil demand is much less. Its energy demand is much less. It's very coal intensive in terms of its electric generation. You know, India, if India grows at 7, 8, 9%, its demand will grow. I know I was on the energy think tank for the Indian government, and clearly the Western companies are very interested, and it's a very important market for the Middle East. You know, it's not going to deliver, I don't think, the outside type of growth that you saw from China, but it will deliver substantial growth if it continues in energy demand, if it continues on its path. India, as you both know, needs reliable, predictable energy supplies and not ones that get interrupted. There is a big program in India for renewables, a very big program, but you have a lot of issues about access to land and so forth. But India also is adding new coal generating capacity and plans to spend about $60 billion to expand its natural gas system. So it's an important market for LNG as well.
And just picking up on that thread about China tariffing U.S. LNG and oil, we've seen a similar flashpoint between the Trump administration and Europe with regards to Europe's CBAM, or Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism. It's increasingly looking like Europe's out of step with the world when it comes to climate policy, with both the developing world and now the U.S. seem to be more squarely prioritizing growth over sustainability. And we're now hearing a lot of pessimism around European growth. Do you think Europe's priorities will have to similarly shift as the rubber meets the road? Do you expect things like CBAM to be fully implemented?
Well, I observed the response from within the developing world to the CBAM, the CBAM, the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism. You know, from the European point of view, it's protecting European industry, allegedly, and also promoting climate agenda. Developing countries, you hear, like from India, where they call it climate imperialism, you know, that we have other things to worry about, like economic growth and poverty. And I think it really highlights one of the factors that I think is driving a redefinition, a rethinking of the energy transition. Look at the thinking about energy transition. A lot of that was shaped during COVID when demand was down and prices were down. And now we've had a couple of years of experience. And well, you know what? The world is different. You know, there are a whole series of forces at work, one of which is this north-south divide, where developing countries are saying, you know, we're not going to be dictated to by Northwest Europe and North America, because we have to deal with economic growth, we have to deal with poverty, we have to deal with health, and our priorities are different. So that's one of the reasons that we can go through the other reasons, too, that, you know, there's just a redefinition, and it's even been enunciated in Europe. You know, there's another aspect. You know, I could go through it. I mean, I think people underestimated the scale and difficulty of transforming what is today a $115 trillion economy in 25 years. It's a pretty big deal. And that it turns out it's not energy transition, it's energy addition, just like it's always been since 1709 when the energy transition began. Energy security wasn't on the agenda. It is now. And this is where that collision between the U.S. and China comes in, because China dominates the supply chains for the minerals that you need if you want to transition to a more electrified economy. You know, the costs are high. And then we already talked about electricity. Suddenly, electricity demand, need for natural gas is greater. So you add all of those things together and being competitive. Oh, and by the way, there's one other thing too, that you do get a backlash. We're getting a backlash in the United States. We'll see how the AfD does in Germany. But one of their major planks of these right-wing populist parties in Germany is opposition to the climate agenda. So if you push it too aggressively, you get a backlash and there's a political cost to it. So there's not a good answer except to recognize energy transition is more difficult. You know, what you expect and how to achieve it needs to be rethought, and it needs to be faced that it's different than it seemed, when you didn't have to worry about supply or prices.
And so now turning to the implications. If we think about the implications of these upheavals, something that's top of mind for us is that we've had entire industries built up around the idea of the green transition in the 2010s. And now, as you've mentioned, you've got President Trump and even some growing political movements in Europe taking a wrecking ball to that idea. And going beyond that, you even have entire countries like China, which really had ambitions of being a global renewable energy superpower with solar, batteries, EVs, and so on. So what happens to these industry-level and country-level ambitions if the world's now moving away from sustainability? To put a point on the question, is the energy transition dead?
Well, I think it'll continue. I mean, these, you know, renewables is a big business. EVs is a big business. Chinese EVs, they're prepared to flood the world with them at prices that are very competitive, which is why Joe Biden put 100% tariff on Chinese EVs. Solar is cheap, although I think we're going to see, and I think it's one of the things we're going to hear at CERAWeek from some of the people who have done very large solar developments, there's the cheap cost of generation and a much bigger cost to integrate the renewables into your system. And I think that's something that needs to be looked at. So I think it will continue, but it won't continue with the same single-minded intensity that you had before. You're going to have a rebalancing, I think. You know, China has that great advantage of low-cost manufacturing, you know, and that drive that Xi Jinping laid out to dominate these supply chains. But I hear even in Southeast Asia, there's talk of tariffs against Chinese imports of some of these technologies.
And now connecting that to what the US is doing with regards to energy security and the geopolitical implications of that. I'd really be interested in your view on what the downstream implications are of the US now having energy security in terms of their willingness to get involved in foreign conflicts, whether it be Iran or Venezuela or elsewhere.
I think it's a major change. I mean, it's hard to remember now the anxiety that was expressed about the U.S. being dependent upon imports in the way it was when it was 60%. And the only question seemed how much higher was it going to go? And that was less than two decades ago, decade and a half ago. I think there's a greater degree of confidence, of flexibility. You know, it's always a question of why is the U.S. concerned about the Gulf? I think those kind of questions there. It's funny where it comes in a different way is the Panama Canal, because we can't, U.S. LNG, the bulk of it, all of it really goes now through the Panama Canal to Asia. And
really?
So you have different geopolitical considerations than you did before. And that hasn't been much in the discussion about why the interest in the Panama Canal subtly. But I think it means that the U.S. is more resilient. I think it led, at least in the last administration, to taking energy security for granted. And if you're in an era where you care less about allies, you know, that is compounded by the independence that you have. Of course, as we discovered with the putative Canadian tariffs, the once and future Canadian tariffs, the U.S. imports 4 million barrels a day of oil from Canada, where we benefit by importing inexpensive Canadian oil, which then enables us to export more valuable other oil to the world. And so we're still tied into the market in ways. And if there is a shock in the system, it will be transmitted to oil prices, whether they're oil is produced in the U.S. or the Middle East. But there's no question that it brings greater security, and it gives the U.S. a degree of influence it didn't have. But we go back to look what U.S. LNG did for Europe. It gives a whole new dimension to and the posture of the United States. Now, I think President Trump is particularly interested in it for using it as a way to address what is front and center of his mind every day, which are trade deficits. But for me, the turning point was when the Iranian attacks on this huge Saudi facility called Abqaiq, which processes 6 million barrels of oil a day. And the price went up for a few days, and then it went down. If that had been back in the time when the U.S. was a major importer, it really would have gone up. But it said to me that, you know, that the security premium is more transient because there is this confidence that comes from knowing those supplies are there. You know, we don't think about energy security as much. We, in fact, take for granted as a country, or did take for granted, you know, this incredible position the U.S. is in because of its supplies. Europe, which didn't think about energy security, now has to worry about energy security a lot. But we see, you know, as oil is still geopolitical, obviously, look at Russian oil and its significance, look at gas. But it's also interesting that minerals, Atul, which is a subject you followed for a long time, which nobody much talked about in terms of geopolitics a few years ago, is front and center. I mean, the Chinese cut off 80% of their tungsten. They have 80% of tungsten supply, and suddenly that's a problem. Those supply chains now get much more scrutiny and concern. It's very hard to permit new projects that would provide some diversification.
And just to tie up everything we've discussed and bring it down to prices, it'd be great if we could get a sense of what your price outlook is for energy, given all of the supply and demand factors we've discussed and all of the implications we've discussed as well. We've been seeing a lot more of this question from clients because President Trump has basically set a soft target at times, right? He's thrown out things like $40 a barrel and so on. Now, a lot of commentators say that President Trump can be sensitive to the stock market, so people are now wondering whether he shares a similar sensitivity to oil prices, given some of his statements. Dan, do you see him doing things like picking up the phone and trying to strong-arm oil-producing nations to up their production? Or can some of the other pressures you described still lead us to a situation where oil prices are uncomfortably high?
It's interesting, you know, the new map, I reconstructed what happened during COVID when prices collapsed. And Trump was, you know, I like really oil low oil prices, but it became clear to him that it was going to devastate the U.S. oil industry. And, you know, people forget now that his administration, Saudi Arabia and Russia, put a floor under oil prices, started the recovery that we now, you know, that we've had ever since. But he is a low oil price guy. I think I've heard the other day he talked about $40 a barrel would be great because it would bankrupt Putin. But I think it seemed to be, you know, when we were in Davos, as oil prices got to 79 to 80, suddenly he was talking, you know, when he was on that Thursday there, he was talking oil prices too high. They've got to produce more oil. So I think, as you say, that is a pressure on it. And we have all the caveats on oil prices about GDP, unexpected events, sanctions, tariff wars, all these things we don't know. But if we look at supply and demand, you know, I think we're using last year, Brent was 81. We're using maybe around right now around $74 a barrel. It's thought 65 to 75. The U.S. oil industry continues to, you know, to be able to. It has to replace supply because shale goes down very fast. But, you know, maybe that's the range. If there are sanctions and disruptions, we could see it move into the higher 70s. But in our own mind, we're sort of thinking sort of mid-70s, low mid-70s for the oil price for 2025 at this point, but always subject to change based upon events.
So, Dan, as we bring this conversation to a close, I really need to ask you, what is the next big dynamic to impact the energy market on a multi-year view? You know, when you released your book, The Prides, it was so well-timed around the events in the Middle East in the 2000s. And your subsequent book, The New Map, we were just coming out of the pandemic. And obviously that dynamic combined with everything else that happened in the 2010s reshaped the global energy market. So now, what's the next big dynamic that will reshape energy markets over the next decade?
You know, my very first book was on the Soviet-American Cold War, actually. And I never expected to be writing about a potential another Cold War, which is a new map. We're in it now. But, you know, it's such an unstable period now, an uncertain period. You know, I haven't found the anchor. So I'm looking for the thing that will help provide the motive force for the story.
Dan, thanks so much for joining us. I always find it really insightful to speak with you.
It was great to have this conversation. So thank you.